So nice to have you back, man.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me back, Nima. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Let's get started with the current situation between Gazans and Israelis. Netanyahu is talking about that we are close to eliminating Hamas. Does it have anything to do with the reality on the battleground?
No, it has absolutely nothing to do with the reality on the battleground. And most of the Israelis know this. I assume Netanyahu knows this as well. It's just very simple that Hamas is the expression of resistance. And the resistance is the result of the occupation. And until you remove the occupation, this is very fundamental, and I don't think anyone argues with this, you will have resistance. And in this case, the resistance will come us. I mean, even if you were able to just completely somehow, you had a magic wand, and you could just remove Hamas from existence. The word doesn't exist anymore. The acronym doesn't exist anymore. Their flags are all gone. People have forgot about that particular entity. There would still be a violent resistance to occupation. So it would just be Hamas under any other name. And Israelis, I think, understand this. They view it as, I think, the more hardline reactionary religious one members or the hardline nationalists. They just view it as something that has to be overcome, that this is what we are up against and this is what we must defeat. And in defeat, in their words, means just subjugation. So either subjugation or an ethnic cleansing, which doesn't seem possible. I think they'll attempt that in the West Bank, that they will, as the months and years go on, they will attempt to replicate what they did in Gaza in the West Bank, maybe town by town, city by city, refugee camp by refugee camp, forcing people out, trying to get them to go to Lebanon or Jordan or Syria or wherever. But I think the idea of a full ethnic cleansing, as they were able to do, say, in 48 or 67, they know that's just not possible, even though they may have had the fever dreams back in the fall of, you know, this is our chance to do so. And of course, if people remember back in late October, which became a reality in the sense of that ridiculous pier the United States constructed that lasted for a few months in the springtime. But that came out of Netanyahu's government, this idea that we're going to build a pier. And the idea was you could bring some stuff in, but more importantly, you can send a lot of stuff out. And that stuff being, of course, the Palestinians. But, you know, you also see it in other ways, too. Over this weekend, I think it was Ynet, the Israeli media outlet Ynet, published a story about how the Israeli military has organizationally set up the apparatus to occupy Gaza for the coming years, so that you see the Israeli army moving forward on its plans, you know, not just having things down on paper, but now actually committing to that, putting officers in charge of what would be the occupation operation, you know, making sure that the agencies, the outfits within the Israeli army are able to coordinate with their civilian counterparts, you know, and setting up as well the whole narrative, the whole storyline of what they're there for, right? You read this thing that came out of Ynet, the way the Israeli military describes their purpose in their coming occupation of Gaza will be to rebuild, you know, to repair what collapsed in Gaza, as if, of course, this is all some type of natural disaster and not a man-made genocide. So this idea, though, that you're going to defeat Hamas, that you're somehow going to militarily have victory in what is essentially a war of resistance against occupation, you know, I mean, only the daftest, only the most ignorant would make such a comment. And I think the Israelis are just preparing themselves that this is what it's going to look like. We are going to subjugate these people and we will keep them under the boot. And that's what it will look like going forward.
Matt, when we talk about Zionism, how we can understand Zionism within Israel? The government is Zionist, the population, how much of the population believes believe in this type of ideology, can we recognize, can we understand what's going on in terms of Zionism within Israel? I'm talking about the population, the government altogether.
And from everything we can ascertain, I've not seen like any real hard figures on this, but you know, even when I was there 7-8 years ago, it was spoken about this idea that the secular Israelis, those who are not Zionists, believing in the greater Israel project, believing in this idea of a Jewish supremacy, right? Of this destiny to fulfill, of controlling all of that land and subjugating those who are not a part of the project or who are in opposition to the Zionist project, right? So again, essentially this project of Jewish supremacy. You know, that those people were leaving, those who were not on board with that, those Israelis who were not on board with that were leaving. And you've heard this over the years. And of course, in the last 11 months, heard that even more. And I mean, even if that's not fully true, what we do know is that those Israelis who are not Zionists in the sense that they endorse this ongoing genocide, say, or even the occupations, are having a lot less children than those who are Zionists. So just on the birth rate aspect of this, the Zionist majority in Israel continues to grow. But by and large, most Israelis are Zionists. I mean, saying all that, by and large, most Israelis are Zionists. I mean, if you look at and they've also been conditioned in a way that their Zionism is not a benign Zionism by any means. It's tied into, I mean, this aspect of Jewish supremacy, which you can divorce, I believe, in concept from the beliefs of Zionism. So I think you could come across a Zionist who is not a Jewish supremacist, who just does believe that the Jews should have their own homeland. But the problem being is that those are few and far between, it seems like. And so when you look at, say, the public opinion polling out of Israel over these last 11 months, as the genocide has just you know, continued on, you see Israelis by and large in line with it. And that's not to be confused with the public opinion polling that's showing that Israelis want a ceasefire. Those are two entirely different things. The reason why a vast majority of Israelis want a ceasefire, why hundreds of thousands, maybe over a million, have been out in the street the last day or two. They had from what I read today earlier, seemed like a successful general strike today, in which, you know, it juxtaposed, you know, I'm here in the U.S. and today is our Labor Day, supposedly, you know, holiday celebrating workers in the worst state for workers in the wealthy, developed world, first world, whatever you want to call it. You know, we've got those that beat us in other parts of the world, but in terms of, like, say, the OECD and things like that, we have to be, if not the worst, we're in the top three or four. But anyway, you know, so juxtapose that, where, my God, can you imagine if we could get a general strike in the United States? And that's not to take away from the great lengths the labor movement in the U.S. has come in the last several years. It really has been, for a lot of us watching this and agreeing with it and happy for it, we've seen a great movement within the labor, great growth within labor in the last bunch of years in the U.S. But the idea of the United States being able to get people onto the streets, like, say, the Israelis did, or many other countries can do around the world. So you saw that today. So even with that, you have a general strike for a ceasefire. And it's not to end the genocide. It's not out of concern for the Palestinians. It's not to demand a two-state solution, right? Or any aspect of negotiations that would lead to some degree of political settlement. No, this is simply about getting the Israeli hostages back. I certainly understand that emotion, and certainly with the six hostages that were killed over the weekend, certainly understand the heartbreak, the anger that comes from that. But at the same time, too, you're not going to see any demonstration of support for the dozens upon dozens of Palestinians killed in Israeli prisons in the last 11 months. So we have to keep that in mind, that the ceasefire demands by the Israeli public are separate from the any idea to end this genocide, let alone to have a pathway towards a two-state solution. We see this clearly, though, the split between the Israeli public on this and Netanyahu's government. And so you just had a vote in the Israeli cabinet where all but one member of the cabinet was in favor of continuing these Netanyahu demands that make a ceasefire impossible, specifically garrisoning, keeping Israeli troops in the Philadelphia corridor, the southern part of Gaza that borders Egypt, you know, as well as other demands too. But even among those who dissented, the one dissent was Yoav Gallant, the defense minister. Even it's really suspect. It's disingenuous, their dissent. Because what General Halevi, the commander of the IDF, the senior general of the IDF, what he said was that, look, take these guys out for 6 weeks, and then when the ceasefire is over, we can put them back in. So even among those who are arguing for Netanyahu to be more conciliatory, to get a deal, it's not because they have any degree of interest in ending this genocide or about heading anywhere towards a final negotiated political settlement that would put behind, you know, these decades and decades of occupation, of suffering, of humiliation, as well as, you know, I mean, I think anyone who is honest and objective about this for the Israelis, they have to recognize that if the Israelis themselves want any degree of security and stability going forward, if they want to stop this process of eating themselves alive, right, this continual diminishment, which, you know, is a real issue for them. You see more and more Israelis speaking about this, how we're destroying ourselves, essentially. They want to arrest that. They want to halt that. They want to make those predictions not come true. The only way to do that is through a negotiated political settlement that delivers a Palestinian state.
And do you think that Zionism is, because it's so amazing how they are putting out their strategy while they're killing many people, but it seems at the end of the day, it doesn't matter how many people they're killing right now, civilians they're killing. At the end of the day, it doesn't seem that they're winning. Yeah. Not their economy is good, not their army is good. This Hezbollah attack on them was, it. We know right now that they have hit some important bases in Israel. Even they didn't use their ballistic right. missiles. You know, when you put all of them together, it doesn't match with the concept of Zionism.
In what way?
Because if they want to win, because at the end of the day, they want to win. Because what we're witnessing right now, it doesn't show that they're winning.
And right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And I think what they're on in their desire for totality and their desire to conquer and to be this divine victor, because again, they I was just reminded, I heard Max Blumenthal the other day say this, that Ben-Gurion said something along the lines of like, I don't believe in God, but God gave me this land. Right. I mean, so for even those who are not the religious, there's a chauvinism involved here that they are entitled to this. And I think in that entitlement, which, you know, it's a fine line between the entitlement and the greed, right? In that their arrogance and their hubris drives them on this pathway, right? So where you, I think for those of us who are looking at this and in our sympathies, of course, of the Palestinian people, but I think many of us are also sympathetic with the Israeli people to a large degree. I mean, the suffering that, say, the families of the hostages are enduring, or the suffering of those who families they've lost sons or daughters or brothers or husbands or whatever in the Israeli army, that's real suffering, you know. And we can divorce our empathy for those people because there, but for the grace of God, go I, in the sense that I was born here, not there, right? What would I have done? But, you know, that type of ability to be objective, as well as holding a base level of empathy for all people, but to have a subjectivity to look at this, what Israel's doing, and saying, this is disastrous. I mean, you have exhausted your army, you've stretched it thin, you've made the army be at odds with the political establishment in a way that is dangerous for any country to have that type of split. You see where the Israeli army, I think, is wants a ceasefire, not just for the ability to rest and reset and refit, but also too because they see this split between the public and the government. And they recognize the danger in that. And they also recognize the role that they play in this because they're not the ones who are able to bring the hostages home. So the Israeli army, always so highly esteemed in Israeli society, are they afraid of losing that bond with the Israeli public because of not being able to get these hostages home, as well as a fallout or as collateral damage to this larger tension that has just blown up within Israel? Of course, you have the political tension in Israel, which I just spoke about, right? That is disastrous, where you have people, hey, is it possible for there to be a civil war in Israel? And not like some type of speculative science fiction, futurist novel type of stuff, but, you know, people really can have that conversation and not have it be absurd. Okay, yeah, I mean, I don't think it's at all possible to be, you know, for the IDF to have a coup or anything like that, as some people have speculated. But this idea of a civil war, you know, where you have these factions that have broken out because they're all armed, they're all fanatical in what they believe, they're all so committed to their cause. Yeah, you could see that happening. I mean, so that's on the political side. And then the economic side has been a catastrophe for Israel. I mean, if Israel did not have the backing of the United States, Nima, they would be in a state of collapse that would be astounding. You know, in a sense of the amount of money that has fled the country, the amount of money that's not coming into the country, tourism, their largest or one of their largest industries has more or less halted. You've had just a blockade that has shut their southernmost port, their only southern facing port, you know, and then we also have reports that tens of thousands of Israeli businesses have gone out of business in these last 10, 11 months. All the reservists who've been called up, the drain on society for that, the 200,000 who are still homeless, whether from the north of Israel, or the south of Israel, who are refugees because of this. I mean, you add all this up and you said, my God, if they didn't have the U.S. Treasury backing them, what would happen to this country? And I think there are many in Israel who recognize we're eating ourselves alive. I also think too, that the Axis resistance, as well as other nations, recognize this too. And I think this may be why you're seeing Iran and Hezbollah and, well, the Yemenis are putting that pressure from the south and the Red Sea. But they've only really attacked Israel, I think, one time. They sent that drone that hit Tel Aviv, which was a great warning, of course. But, you know, certainly, too, with the what the Iraqi resistance could do, the Syrian resistance could do, you know, in terms of constantly attacking Israel, I feel like they have settle back on a long-term approach to this where they recognize Israel is falling apart from within, as well as the American empire, as well as weakening, and that this is a long game that we should be playing, that we should be very prudent and thoughtful in our actions and take a long-term approach to this. And yeah, exhaust the Israelis, get them, have them so stressed out, have them so stretched thin militarily, have their economy just continue to bleed because nothing can get stable. And that's how you see victory, not next week, not in 5 months, maybe not in 5 years. But, you know, I mean, at some point, you know, it becomes a failed state that is only propped up in many ways, I would say reminiscent of Afghanistan. And I think you could get to this point in Israel where you have the Israeli political leadership resembling the Afghan Taliban, not in, you know, the direct ways, but in the sense that they just don't care about the world and that they're willing to do whatever their principles, whatever their God tells them to do. And to hell with the world, we're Fortress Israel. We're not just Greater Israel, we're Fortress Israel. And as long as we have the United States backing, you know, as long as that hose is connected to us and keeps us inflated, we'll be okay. And isn't this what our religion demands? Isn't this what our theocratic history teaches us? Isn't this the plight of our people, that everyone's against us, right? So for these people too, it just makes sense on a narrative level. Yeah. So I mean, I think that's what we're seeing here on the you know, in the macro, in terms of the relations between these countries, as well as what's happening internally in Israel, which I think in any, you know, and there's a great, I want to say great, but like there's a Haaretz editorial last week that followed up on the head of Shin Bet, which is the roughly the Israeli equivalent of the FBI, Ronan Barr. He wrote this blistering letter to the PM, to the cabinet, to Knesset, saying Jewish terror within our country is the biggest threat to us, right? So it gets back to this idea of a civil war, but also too, he was specifically talking about the settlers and their actions in the West Bank and how their actions are endangering us, and you know, and how we're heading for a downfall here. And the Haaretz editorial about his letter, you know, began with the words, "In any normal country, you know, such and such would be, you know," and that's the case here. In any normal country, and Israel is by no means any normal country.
Yeah. Matt, the other thing we've learned that Hamas is talking about, Israelis were killing six, Israeli army were killing six Israelis that they have been hostages of in Rafah. And the same kind of manner we've seen on October 7th, they're killing Israelis. Right now in Rafah, it seems that they've been killing six Israelis in Rafah. Hamas is talking about this. And when they're thinking of this type of manner, do you think morally and strategically how they can convince themselves of these attacks and how they would benefit from these attacks?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's still, I think, open as to who killed those Israeli hostages. But right before we came on, I saw posts on Twitter, on X, purportedly saying that Hamas has more or less accepted responsibility for it, along the lines that after the Israeli raid that freed the three hostages a couple months ago and killed 275 or so Palestinians, that Hamas changed their rules for the guardianship of these hostages in the sense that if anyone approaches, the rules are now different. Hamas did not specifically, in what I read, Hamas has not specifically said we killed them. And what they said about the rules is kind of vague, but it's enough to read between the lines saying that, you know, this is the this is what's going to continue to happen. I mean, I don't know why anyone thinks that's kind of obscene or abnormal, because isn't that the whole purpose of taking hostages? And I mean, isn't that kind of like the reality of hostage taking? If someone tries to rescue them, you kill the hostages. Isn't that the, you know, I mean, haven't we seen that in the movies? You know, I mean, so the fact that Hamas has not done that prior to this, 11 months into this genocide, they had a couple of Israeli hostages who were killed a few weeks ago. Hamas admitted to that and they explained the circumstances of it. And one of the guards had lost family members and in his anger, he killed these people. I mean, so, but just the idea though, that it could have been the Israelis that killed them accidentally, or you know, and one of the things I saw actually, you know, Nima, that was interesting over the weekend was a comment from, I can't remember off the top of my head who it was from, but it was on the side within the Israeli government. It may have been anonymous, the side that's pushing for a negotiated ceasefire. And the comment was along the lines that there are only 30 who are left alive, right? So of the 100 and some odd, 106 or so that are still technically hostages, this comment may have betrayed that the Israelis understand that only 30 are left alive. It may have been something to throw away, but you're looking at this bombing, you're looking at the attacks, these assaults, how could they be alive, right? I mean, how could not more of them have been killed? You know, but the idea you're getting at, though, is whether or not whoever killed these hostages, it allows the narrative to continue that Hamas, and then as a result, the Palestinians are barbaric, that they are uncivilized, that they are not human. Look how they act. They kill. I mean, and you see that narrative just on display here in the U.S. in the last day or so with the announcement that these hostages have been killed. I mean, the banner headlines and all the American media about this, and the anger, the righteous anger, you know, that just sends the emotion, that just pushes the desire for revenge. I mean, it doesn't do anything. In Israel, you're seeing that opposite backlash where the people are angry at Netanyahu because of this, because he's not getting the hostages back and he's delaying the negotiations, doing everything he can not to have any type of settlement for his own, essentially his own political purpose, and those around whom who believe in continuing this war, and that hey, look, if we lose a few hostages in order of achieving greater Israel, then so be it. Isn't that what God would want us to do? Isn't that what the Bible teaches us happened? You know what I mean? So like that mindset there. But here in the U.S. and in the West, these headlines make it so why should Kamala Harris say that she'll push negotiations? When they talked to Joe Biden today at the White House, you know, it was his anger at these hostages being killed. You know, the commentary says nothing about the Palestinians whatsoever. So whether it's a New York Times or a CNN article that discusses this, where they'll make the perfunctory nod to 40,000 have been killed in the Hamas-Israel war, right? And leave it at that as if it's some type of conventional force-on-force type thing where unfortunately sometimes civilians get caught in crossfire. Whether it's that, or the fact that they will completely ignore the dozens upon dozens. The last number I saw was 63, I believe, and that was several weeks ago, of Palestinian prisoners who've been killed in Israeli jails since October 7th, let alone the thousands and thousands who've been arbitrarily detained there. And as we have seen from documentation from organization after organization, whether it's the United Nations or whether it's B'Tselem, the Israeli Human Rights Organization, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, whether it's journalists, certainly not journalists from the West, but journalists from, say, Al Jazeera or Al Mayadeen, you have seen these reports that are so well established of the systematic torture of Palestinian hostages in Israeli prisons. I mean, it's undeniable. The way that B'Tselem, the Israeli Human Rights Organization, described it was that it was purposeful. Every prisoner, every hostage got tortured. It's just the way the system is set up. It's almost like an assembly line-like process to ensure everybody is tortured, they're degraded, they're humiliated. It's a form of punishment, form that to bring great fear and distress throughout the Palestinian population, from a collective punishment, of course, but also as a warning, and also to directly, you know, give a relief valve to the Israelis, to see actual faces that are being tortured. Does the torture? It's just not torture. It's the deprivation of food, deprivation safety from exposure. They're kept outside. They're not kept from the elements. They sleep in the cold, they're out in the heat, as well as to the rapes. And we hear this over and over again about the rapes by the Palestinians, which more or less there's been no documentation about that. Did rapes occur on October 7th? I wouldn't doubt it. Was it a mass systemic rape as an act of war strategy? Absolutely not. And even the numbers of rapes, it's very doubtful that it was very many. Again, we've had no documentation. We've had no evidence of this. There's just a thing last week, 2 weeks ago in Israel, where there's supposedly a survivor of the October 7th attacks left a suicide note and committed suicide. And Channel 13 in Israel exposed that this is just another hoax, just another made up thing about October 7th. I mean, real tragedy there, real suffering, real horror on that day. But the use of the propaganda to depict Hamas as evil, which this killing of the hostages will do, is meant to make it so that if and when negotiations fail, as the genocide continues, the vitriol, the rhetoric, the dialogue in the West, and particularly in the U.S. during the presidential campaign, is that you can't negotiate with these people. And we've seen that before. This is standard American policy when it goes to wars, that there is only a victory narrative. In whether it was Afghanistan, where you can't negotiate with the Taliban, whether it was in Iraq, where you cannot negotiate with the Sunnis, you can't negotiate with the Shia, whether it was in Syria, where you cannot negotiate with Assad, or Libya, where you can't negotiate with Gaddafi, even though you know, plenty of negotiations have been done with Gaddafi. You know, I mean, remember, like in the months before, you know, the NATO attacks on Libya, the U.S. State Department is writing cables about how much of a trusted partner Muammar Gaddafi and his government are. You know what I mean? Like things like that. You know, this is all part of it. It's all part of the propaganda. This is what enables the war to keep going. So the deaths of these hostages, and I feel terrible for their families, enable the war to continue, right? And at best, what you'll get out of this is you'll get the Israeli government to relent and to say yes, and that they will agree to a ceasefire deal, that Hamas has already agreed to multiple times. Another thing that's left out entirely in the American media. You know, you will never see reference to the fact that Hamas has accepted these ceasefire deals, and then the Israelis and the Americans have amended the deal, have changed the deal. And then, right, I mean, so basically, you know, in the United States, we have a comic comic strip and an animated cartoon, Peanuts. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that. And Lucy and Charlie Brown. And every time Charlie Brown goes to kick the football, Lucy pulls it away from him every time. And that's essentially what we're dealing with here. You know, I mean, so I think at best what you'll get because of these deaths is that ceasefire deal, which, as we know, because General Halevi just said it out loud the other day, literally 2 days ago, once the 6 weeks is over, we can go right back in. So it'll be disingenuous, it'll be specious. We understand what the Israelis want. They want that dominance. They want that subjugation. They want that collective punishment. They want the genocide to just become a continuous operation. And, you know, as we were discussing earlier, they're planning for it. They're getting ready for it. And they're going to have their people in place to do it.
Yeah. Again, when we talk about the foreign policy of the United States in Israel and in Gaza, you see Donald Trump and Kamala Harris, and we know that what Donald Trump gonna do if he wins, because we have his first term to evaluate what he's gonna do. And here comes Kamala Harris on CNN. She's talking about the conflict between Israel and Gazans.
And has tried unsuccessfully to end the war between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. He's been doing it for months and months, along with you. Would you do anything differently? For example, would you withhold some U.S. weapons shipments to Israel? That's what a lot of people on the progressive left want you to do.
Let me be very clear. I'm unequivocal and unwavering in my commitment to Israel's defense and its ability to defend itself. And that's not going to change. But let's take a step back. October 7, 1,200 people were massacred. Many young people who were simply attending a music festival. Women were horribly raped. As I said then, I say today, Israel has a right to defend itself. We would. And how it does so matters. Far too many innocent Palestinians have been killed. And we have got to get a deal done. We were in Doha. We have to get a deal done. This war must end.
In the meantime,
and we must get a deal that is about getting the hostages out. I've met with the families of the American hostages. Let's get the hostages out. Let's get the ceasefire done.
But no change in policy in terms of arms and so forth.
No, we have to get a deal done. Dana, we have to get a deal done. When you look at the significance of this, to the families, to the people who are living in that region. A deal is not only the right thing to do to end this war, but will unlock so much of what must happen next. I remain committed since I've been on October 8 to what we must do to work toward a two-state solution where Israel is secure and in equal measure the Palestinians have security and self-determination and dignity.
Yeah,
none of that makes any sense. I mean, none of it makes any sense. I mean, the things she says are absurd. They're untrue, not logical. I mean, the idea that somehow that we're going to continue this policy and that's going to result in Palestinians having stability and security and self-determination. What? Because the Israeli government is also going to turn on a dime? The entire Israeli government is against a Palestinian state. They've made that clear over and over and over again. I mean, the whole, almost as if when she got starts to get emotional there and a little bit upset, Kamala Harris says, we have to get a deal done. I feel as if what she is intending to say is we have to get a deal done because this is hurting my presidential, my chances in November, that this is hurting my presidential campaign. We have to get a deal done for that reason. I mean, none of it makes any sense otherwise, why she's been saying anything like that. This idea that somehow first of all, to take it back to the moderator, to the interviewer, Dana Bash at CNN there, and when she says that some on the progressive left want to end weapon sales to Israel or have a stop sending weapons to Israel, it's not some on the progressive left. It's a majority of Americans. 61% of Americans want to stop sending weapons to Israel. Almost 80% of Democrats want to stop sending weapons to Israel. And this is where you really see just how nefarious, how corrupt, how rotten the American system is, where this is like a no-brainer, particularly for a Democrat, where you've got eight out of 10, right? Four out of five, if I'm doing my math right, Democrats who are saying, we support not sending any more weapons to Israel. And that is the way that you get a ceasefire deal, is by applying that type of leverage. This is all basic stuff, you know what I mean? And Kamala Harris is insistent that we have to have a ceasefire deal. Okay, then A to B to C. But it shows just how corrupt the whole thing is, because it's all controlled by, in this case, on these policies. And the same thing occurs with, say, agriculture or healthcare or whatever in the U.S. It's controlled by a special interest group. In this case, it's the Israeli lobby. Harris's, and the overall Democratic pushback, not supporting Harris because of this, has been that the Republicans would be worse, that Donald Trump would be worse. And it's impossible to contemplate that, to accept that. Even if Donald Trump was to say to the Israelis, go ahead, do whatever you want, which is essentially what the U.S. has said to the, what Biden administration has said to the Israelis, what more could they do? Absent dropping a nuclear weapon, what more could, the Israeli army is only so big, their air force can only fly so many sorties, they only have so many artillery pieces to fire 155 shells into populated neighborhoods, right? There's not much more they could have done. If someone can come up with something, why it would be worse if Trump was in office now for the people of Gaza than Biden Harris in office right now, please write it in the comments. Because again, aside from dropping a nuclear weapon there, I'm not sure how much more Israel could be doing on a realistic sense. So the whole thing, all of what she said there, it's lies. It's nonsense. It's Orwellian fiction. And of course, her base, her party eats it up, and they parrot it. This is one of the things I'm upset with. A lot of us are upset with what we used to consider progressives in the U.S. House of Representatives among the squad, as many are now calling it the fraud squad, which is more or less correct, their unwillingness to speak about this. I think that the big example is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And this shows the power of, again, the Israeli lobby, but overall the legalized bribery that is the American political system, how important it is, how this is what really matters in American politics is the money. You see someone like AOC, who's given the opportunity to address the Democratic National Convention, and she lies for Harris. She says the Biden-Harris team are working tirelessly to bring about a ceasefire and to bring the hostages home. Again, the primacy, all the attention is on the hostages, nothing about this genocide that's occurring to the Palestinian people. I mean, the convention, the delegates there, they're nothing more than trained SEALs. You can go up there and you can say whatever, and they're going to applaud. And we've seen this throughout the Democratic Party's support for Harris. And the same applies for Republicans. Trump can say anything and his supporters will applaud him. He could go just like he did last week when he went to Arlington Cemetery and try to do a photo op, try to make a campaign ad at the grave sites of veterans. And his people, who are all the most patriotic types in the United States, will stand by him. As opposed to saying, hey, that was wrong, that was messed up, and the same is with the Democrats. And we saw that, of course, what Harris, not even a week into her campaign, tells the Palestinian protesters, some of whom had had dozens of family members killed, to shut up. And then 2 days later, she's at another thing and she says, we must get a ceasefire. In both cases, when she's telling the Palestinian protesters to shut up, or she's saying we need a ceasefire, her audience, her supporters, erupt in applause, right? So AOC could have stood up there at the DNC and said, we need to end this genocide. And the delegates, because, again, they're nothing more than clapping seals, would have erupted in support. You know, and so you see this, though, this bowing to the pressures of this system that's controlled by money. And, you know, the idea that somehow it could be worse, it's just hard to even grasp that, how it could be worse. But we also understand that it's not going to change, that Harris is honest, at least in that point, where there will be no change in policy, and that this continuation of suffering and destruction of the Palestinian people will continue, whether it's a Trump administration or, excuse me, a Harris administration.
Yeah. Not shifting the gear to the conflict in Ukraine right now, we've learned that Ukrainian economy minister Yulia Siridenko, she's asking for $800 million from the U.S. to pay for their energy infrastructures. And the way that they're thinking, in your opinion, right now within the Zelensky administration, do they really think that forever the United States is going to provide them with weapons, with money to build? Because the way that they're planning for the future of their country, it's their country that they have to take care of their country. It doesn't seem that they do think this way. Unbelievable what's going on right now with the reality on the battleground and what's going on in the mindset of the Zelensky administration.
And the reality of their country, the reality of their economy, their infrastructure. She said that the economics minister said about 6-7 months ago, maybe it was even end of last year, that Ukraine had a shortage of 3 to 4 million workers, that they just don't have enough people to keep the economy going. I think that is the approach that the Russians are taking here. Yeah, they're making real steady advances in the east. I mean, they're also not galloping a dozen miles a day or 20 miles a day, you know, outpacing their artillery coverage or their air defense coverage or something like that, like causing a real problem tactically and operationally for themselves. But they're advancing a kilometer, maybe a mile every day, it seems like, you know, but the idea for them has to be this continual wear them down. And whereas a lot of people focus on the front lines, on the military aspect of this, it's really, to me, the most important thing is the ability for the government to stay in power and the economy. And if either of those collapse, that's where Ukraine becomes a failed state. And at that point, you know, Russia especially, as well as, say, Hungary, Slovakia, Poland, Romania, Moldova, you know, are in a real dangerous place, because now you got a failed state that is basically going to fall apart into a consortium of warlords, right? As well as all this cash and weapons and everything else flowing around. And so that's something that really has to be avoided. And I know that has to concern the Russians right now, this idea of Ukraine collapsing. They, of course, they'd love to see the government in Kyiv fall, but there's no way to do that in a managed way, right? And I think even if they had gotten what they wanted the Russians with the negotiations in 2022, it would have, you know, having Kyiv in power, as long as they fell under a neutral status, having those, you know, Zelensky and others in power, they could live with that as long as that neutrality status was there. And now, of course, it doesn't seem like there's any way to remove that government in Kyiv without there being a collapse or some type of coup, which is only going to introduce even more hardline elements into Kyiv, right? So the Russians can't get anywhere that way. And that, you also have an emboldening, the Kursk operation for the Ukrainians has been very successful, because it has completely, as Politico said, flipped the gloomy narrative of the Ukrainian war. And, you know, so you have in the West, you have in DC and in London, all this triumphant triumphalist, victory type remarks coming from all the usual suspects. I just heard one from Boris Johnson the other day, but it's renewed this. It's given it strength. And so the idea now in the West is once again, the idea of negotiations is defeatist. Didn't you see what the Ukrainians did? Did you see how they embarrassed them? Putin's on his back foot. All that stuff, it means that we can't negotiate now, which is what keeps the regime in Kyiv in power, which is their whole purpose. And for those so when you get back to the questions, what are they expecting? Yeah, they're expecting to continue to live on this lifeline that's provided to them in many similar ways, so that there'd be an American lifeline to greater Israel, to fortress Israel, that keeps it afloat, that keeps it from collapsing, right? That keeps the house of cards, the table on which it stands, steady. And that's the idea. So we got to keep this narrative going, right? So we got to have this, we got to make sure that our backers have the propaganda they need to shut down any voices who would challenge this idea of sending, United States alone has, the Congress has appropriated $175 billion for Ukraine in 2.5 years, right? So, I mean, you're looking at essentially $75, $80 billion a year. And that appropriation will come up again in December. So we got to make sure that we have the narrative that supports that. And that's essentially it. But Ukraine's economy is in really terrible shape. Even though we just sent them a huge tranche of the $60 billion that was approved for them by the U.S. Congress back in April, was that? You've had the EU provide money, whether through its member states or by sending the interest off of frozen Russian assets. And it's still not enough. The Ukrainians, by at least two credit rating agencies last month, got downgraded to pre-default status, I think by Moody's and by Fitch. So in the sense that these rating agencies are looking at this and are saying, this government's not gonna be able to pay its debt. It's already had to absolve a lot of that debt that the Ukrainians a few months ago just said, we're not paying this. So you have this issue where the money is has always been a very, very big conserve for keeping this economy afloat, keeping the government in power, but it's starting to reach critical stages. And I'll remind people that if you look at Afghanistan and the way that collapse in Afghanistan begins for the Afghan government, it's when Biden in February 2021 says that we are not staying in Afghanistan. And then the panic begins, because even though we're still sending a lot of money to Afghanistan, because it's a corrupt, the government's a kleptocracy, essentially. The military is essentially a business deal, that the patronage network starts to shut down. And that's what you would see in Ukraine as well. The threat of the money no longer coming, or not enough money coming. Well, that means that I'm not just going to take my cut and send the rest down the line. I'm going to hold all of it, because I don't think anything more is coming. And when that happens, you start to then have the panic. You have the collapse. People aren't being paid. People start to, right? I mean, all the things that you've seen happen, Afghanistan just being the most recent and best example, because it really was a consequence of an American imperial proxy war, which is no different than what the Ukrainians are fighting. So, I think that, you're still militarily in a status quo there, in the sense that neither side can knock each other out with a punch, so to speak. But the big thing for the Ukrainians is going to be, can we keep ourselves afloat? Can we keep this house of cards from collapsing? The manpower for their army is certainly a big issue, but I think that their bigger concern is just the money coming into their economy.
The other thing would be, Matt, the concept and the strategy of Europeans right now. Do you think that they're helping Zelensky and his administration? They're giving giving a hope to Ukrainians that doesn't mean for the future, because right now we've learned that the government in Netherlands talking about, go ahead, we're going to help you, we're going to support you. Yeah. But how are you going to support him with the current situation? And they're not helping themselves. They're not helping you. And at the end of the day, it doesn't seem that they're understanding what's going on in Ukraine to help them to bring some sort of sanity to the whole situation, to this mess that we're witnessing right now in Ukraine.
Well, I mean, even in the U.S., support for the Ukraine war has dropped dramatically, right? I mean, majority of Americans are not in favor, really, of this thing going forward. Most Americans feel that there should be a negotiated settlement, and that's the way most Europeans are. But in the U.S., where this war has been so heavily propagandized, I'm not saying it hasn't been in Europe, and where we haven't felt anything, we have, because inflation for the energy sector as well as for foodstuffs, you know, there's a connection to the Ukraine war there. But for most Americans, that connection is not obvious. For the Europeans, though, it has been very obvious. And the strain that this war has put on them, either through inflation or, say, through refugees, or through just the having to watch your politicians just pursue this reckless and unwinnable war for the benefit of the American empire, right? So sell out our own people in order to keep themselves in the good graces of Uncle Sam, right? I mean, make sure we're the first among vassals. We don't want to fall to that second tier. God forbid we fall down to where Hungary or Slovakia are, you know? I mean, so they see that, and you're seeing the results, though, in elections all throughout Europe. Right. I mean, we just had the Germans just had elections, state elections this weekend, where the right wing AfD did very well in the two states that had elections. And in the election that's coming up, I think this week in Brandenburg, they're projected to do even better. And then there's a left wing party as well that just stood up in the last couple of years. And remember, AfD has only been around for a decade or so. I mean, so, you know, what they're the damage that's being done to the traditional parties. I think in these two states that had elections where AfD got about a third of the vote and this left-wing party got about 15% of the vote, if I remember correctly, the Olaf Scholz's Social Democrats and the Greens and whichever the third party is in that mix there, they all got like single-digit percentages. You know, I mean, so we saw the results in French elections. We saw the results in the British elections where, you know, you have to understand how the British system works to understand how it really wasn't that big of a Labour win. You know, I mean, like the writing is all there that the people of Europe are exhausted by this. They're tired by they're being hurt by this. And the unfortunate thing, though, as we know, is that when people get like that, actors like AfD can take advantage, and it becomes as much about the fealty of your politicians to the American empire as it does about these, you know, dangerous, rabid Muslim immigrants who are ruining our way of life and threatening our wives and daughters, like that type of hysteria. But that's you've got to take that in the same breath, because that's the reality of when a people are weakened, when they're dispossessed by their own government, when they're hurting like this, makes them very susceptible. That's just the way history works. That's the way humans in our society operate. You know, so that's the thing that bothers me about this. Be one thing if a bishop like, yeah, great, there's going to be a reckoning in Europe, and these guys are going to get thrown out. And the Greens, because I'm a green here in the U.S. and not much of a connection, but like, yeah, I really want to see Annalisa Baerbock and those folks, you know, get their comeuppance for supporting this war at the expense of their people and everything else, you know. And it'd be one thing if that was it. But the problem is it's never that simple. It's never going to work out that way, because like, damn it, you know, rather than just being like this overthrow of the corrupt politicians that put you in this place, that hurt you and your people, enabled this unwinnable war to continue, the suffering in Ukraine, they get thrown out of power. They should get thrown in jail, but at least they're getting thrown out of power. You also then have, though, the fact that you have groups like AfD that benefit from it. But the idea of what they're doing, to your question about how they think they're helping Zelensky or how they're helping the Ukrainian people, they certainly are helping Zelensky. I mean, in the sense that they're keeping him in power. They're the ones who gave him this idea that he could be his generation or this century's Churchill, right? They're the ones who have enabled him to play the greatest role he will ever play in his life. Remember, he's an actor. Remember, he dresses in a costume every day. He's got his little hunting outfit on and whatnot. For Zelensky personally, and they're also the ones that keep him safe at this point from the far right elements in Ukraine, because I think the Europeans are not like the Americans in the sense that they don't want to dance with the devil as the Americans do. Like Americans, we will partner up with the worst of the worst. We do it all the time. I mean, like, look at what the Americans say about what's his name, Jelani, down there in Syria, right? About how he's not that bad, and how HTS, we can, you know, they're not that bad. And, but this other group, what is it called? The ones we just attacked, HTD or whoever they are down there. Like as if there's some difference in these jihadist bin Laden al-Qaeda groups. You know, my friend Scott Horton is so good on this subject. But the Europeans aren't so inclined to do that. So I think the idea of they want to see Zelensky be successful because they don't want to see the right come into power. But the problem is so many of these events are propelled upon their own inertia, and they're propelled by things that can't be undone in just a couple of good propaganda PR news hits. You're talking about people's lives have been upended. I mean, when you're in Britain and you hear the slogan "heat or eat," you know, which they are saying a year or so ago, about a year and a half ago, about what, because their food prices were so high and their energy prices were so high. You know, you can't just trot out like a good looking politician to make everyone feel better about that. And that resentment's going to continue to grow. And so, yeah, I mean, like, this is something I think that we've discussed before about how oftentimes what we think is the main act is not the main act. And the Ukraine war may not be the main act, just as Gaza, but, you know, forgive me for saying this, I don't want to take anything away from that genocide that's occurring there, may not be the main act that's occurring in the Middle East. You know, an example I use, of course, is the Balkans war that precedes World War One, you know, from 1912 through 1913, where a lot of people are killed. I mean, there's terrible, terrible atrocities there. Ethnic cleansing essentially is occurring. You know, over a million people killed, right? And if at the time you're looking at that, you're like, my God, how could this get any worse? This has to be the main act. And oh, wait, this was just a prelude? You know, so that's why I worry about Ukraine, is that as bad as it is, maybe it's just a prelude or something to come that is not what we're thinking, and not because most of us stress out rightfully about this idea of a US NATO versus Russia war, which of course, but maybe something else comes from this that we can't foresee, because war, of course, is a breeding ground of not just unintended consequences, but unforeseeable consequences. And so, you know, what's to come, I'm afraid that this might not be it.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Matt, for being with us today. Great pleasure as always.
Hey, thank you, Nima.